Nobody got murdered before lunch. But nobody. People weren't up to it. You needed a good lunch to get both the blood sugar and blood lust levels up. Dirk had the figures to prove it. Did he, Anstey? The client's name was Anstey, an odd, intense man in his mid-30s, with staring eyes, a narrow yellow tie, and one of the big houses in Lupton Road. Dirk hadn't actually liked him very much and thought he looked as if he was trying to swallow a fish. Did he know that 67% of all known murderers who expressed a preference had had liver and bacon for lunch? And that another 22% had been torn between either a prawn biryani or an omelette? That dispensed with 89% of the threat at a stroke, and by the time you had further discounted the salad eaters and the turkey and ham sandwich munchers, and started to look at the number of people who wouldn't contemplate such a course of action without any lunch at all, then you were well into the realms of negligibility and bordering on fantasy. After 2:30, but nearer to 3 o'clock, was when you had to start being on your guard, seriously, even on good days. Even when you weren't receiving death threats from strange, gigantic men with green eyes, you had to watch people like a hawk after the lunching hour. The really dangerous time was after 4 o'clock-ish, when the streets began to fill up with marauding packs of publishers and agents maddened with fettuccine and kheer and baying for cabs. Those were the times that tested men's souls. 6:30 in the morning, forget it. Dirk had. With his resolve well stiffened, Dirk stepped back out of the newsagents into the nippy air of the street and strode off. "Ah, I expect you'll be wanting to pay for that paper, then, won't you, Mr. Dirk, sir?" said the newsagent, trotting gently after him. "Ah, Bates," said Dirk loftily, "you and your expectations, always expecting this and expecting that. May I recommend serenity to you? A life that is burdened with expectations is a heavy life. Its fruit is sorrow and disappointment. Learn to be one with the joy of the moment." "I think it's 20p, that one, sir," said Bates tranquilly. "Tell you what I'll do, Bates, seeing as it's you. Do you have a pen on you at all? A simple ballpoint will suffice." Bates produced one from an inner pocket and handed it to Dirk, who then tore off the corner of the paper on which the price was printed and scribbled IOU above it. He handed the scrap of paper to the newsagent. "Shall I put this with the other ones then, sir?" "Put it wherever it'll give you the greatest joy, dear Bates. I would want you to put it nowhere less. For now, dear man, farewell. I expect you'll be wanting to give me my pen back as well, Mr. Dirk." "When the times are propitious for such a transaction, my dear Bates," said Dirk, "you may depend upon it. For the moment, higher purposes call it. Joy, Bates, great joy. Bates, please let go of it." After one last listless tug, the little man shrugged and padded back towards his shop. "I expect I'll be seeing you later, then, Mr. Dirk," he called out over his shoulder, without enthusiasm. Dirk gave a gracious bow of his head to the man's retreating back, and then hurried on, opening the newspaper at the horoscope page as he did so. "Virtually everything you decide today will be wrong," it said bluntly. Dirk slapped the paper shut with a grunt. He did not for a second hold with the notion that great whirling lumps of rock light-years away knew something about your day that you didn't. It just so happened that the great Zaganza was an old friend of his who knew when Dirk's birthday was and always wrote his column deliberately to wind him up. The paper's circulation had dropped by nearly a twelfth since he had taken over doing the horoscope, and only Dirk and the great Zaganza knew why. He hurried on, flapping his way quickly through the rest of the paper. As usual, there was nothing interesting. A lot of stuff about the search for Janice Smith, the missing airline girl from Heathrow, and how she could possibly have disappeared just like that. They printed the latest picture of her, which was on a swing with pigtails aged 6. Her father, Mr. Jim Pierce, was quoted as saying it was quite a good likeness, but she had grown up a lot now and was usually in better focus. Impatiently, Dirk tucked the paper under his arm and strode onwards, his thoughts on a much more interesting topic. £300 a day, plus expenses. He wondered how long he could reasonably expect to sustain in Mr. Anstey his strange delusions that he was about to be murdered by a 7-foot-tall, shaggy-haired creature with huge green eyes and horns, who habitually waved things at him, a contract written in some incomprehensible language and signed with a splash of blood, and also a kind of scythe. The other notable feature of this creature was that no one other than his client had been able to see it, which Mr. Anstey dismissed as a trick of the light. 3 days? 4? Dirk didn't think he'd be able to manage a whole week with a straight face, but he was already looking at something like a grand for his trouble, and he would stick a new fridge down on the list of tangential but non-negotiable expenses. That would be a good one. Getting the old fridge thrown out was definitely part of the interconnectedness of all things. He began to whistle at the thought of simply getting someone to come round and cart the thing away, turned into Lupton Road, and was surprised at all the police cars there, and the ambulance. He didn't like them being there. It didn't feel right. It didn't sit comfortably in his mind alongside his visions of a new fridge. Dirk knew Lupton Road. It was a wide, tree-lined affair, with large, late-Victorian terraces which stood tall and sturdily and resented police cars. Resented them if they turned up in numbers, that is, and if their lights were flashing. The inhabitants of Lupton Road liked to see a nice, well-turned-out single police car patrolling up and down the street in a cheerful and robust manner. It kept property values cheerful and robust, too. But the moment the lights started flashing in that knuckle-whitening blue, they cast their pallor not only on the neatly pointed bricks that they flashed across, but also on the very values those bricks represented. Anxious faces peered from behind the glass of neighbouring windows and were irradiated by the blue strobes. There were three of them. Three police cars left askew across the road in a way that transcended mere parking. It sent out a massive signal to the world saying that the law was here now and taking charge of things, and that anyone who just had normal, good and cheerful business to conduct in Lupton Road could just fuck off. Dirk hurried up the road, sweat pricking at him beneath his heavy leather coat. A police constable loomed up ahead of him with his arms spread out, playing at being a stop barrier. But Dirk swept him aside in a torrent of words to which the constable was unable to come up with a good response off the top of his head. Dirk sped on to the house. At the door, another policeman stopped him, and Dirk was about to wave an expired Marks & Spencer charge card at him with the deft little flick of the wrist that he had practiced for hours in front of a mirror on those long evenings when nothing much else was on, when the officer suddenly said, "Hey, is your name Gently?" Dirk blinked at him warily. He made a slight grunting noise that could be either yes or no, depending on the circumstances.
Because the chief has been looking for you.
"Has he?" said Dirk.
"I recognise you from his description," said the officer, looking him up and down with a slight smirk. "In fact," continued the officer, "he's been using your name in a manner that some might find highly offensive. He even sent Big Bob the Finder off in a car to find you. I can tell you didn't, from the fact that you're looking reasonably well. A lot of people get found by Big Bob the Finder, they come in a bit wobbly. Just about able to help us with our inquiries, but that's about all. You better go in. Rather you than me," he added quietly.
Dirk glanced at the house. The stripped pine shutters were closed across all the windows. Though in all other respects the house seemed well cared for, groomed into a state of clean, well-appointed affluence, the closed shutters seemed to convey an air of sudden devastation. Oddly, there seemed to be music coming from the basement, or rather, just a single disjointed phrase of thumping music being repeated over and over again. It sounded as if the stylus had got stuck in the groove of a record, and Dirk wondered why no one had turned it off, or at least nudged the stylus along so that the record could continue. The song seemed very vaguely familiar, and Dirk guessed that he had probably heard it on the radio recently, though he couldn't place it. The fragment of lyrics seemed to be something like, "Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up," and so on.
"You'll be wanting to go down to the basement," said the officer, impassively, as if that was the last thing that anyone in their right mind would be wanting to do.
Dirk nodded to him curtly and hurried up the steps to the front door, which was standing slightly ajar. He shook his head and clenched his shoulders, trying to stop his brain fluttering. He went in. The hallway spoke of prosperity imposed on a taste that had originally been formed by student living. The floors were stripped boards, heavily polyurethaned. The walls white, with Greek rugs hung on them, but expensive Greek rugs. Dirk would be prepared to bet, though probably not to pay up, that a thorough search of the house would reveal, amongst who knew what other dark secrets, 500 British Telecom shares and a set of Dylan albums that was complete up to Blood on the Tracks. Another policeman was standing in the hall. He looked terribly young, and he was leaning very slightly back against the wall, staring at the floor and holding his helmet against his stomach. His face was pale and shiny. He looked at Dirk blankly and nodded faintly in the direction of the stairs leading down. Up the stairs came the repeated sound. "Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it." Dirk was trembling with a rage that was barging around inside him, looking for something to hit or throttle. He wished that he could hotly deny that any of this was his fault, but until anybody tried to assert that it was, he couldn't. "How long have you been here?" he said curtly. The young policeman had to gather himself together to answer.
"We arrived about half hour ago," he replied in a thick voice. "Hell of a morning, rushing around."
"Don't tell me about rushing around," said Dirk, completely meaninglessly. He launched himself down the stairs. "Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it." At the bottom, there was a narrow corridor. The main door off it was heavily cracked and hanging off its hinges. It opened into a large double room. Dirk was about to enter when a figure emerged from it and stood barring his way. "I hate the fact that this case has got you mixed up in it," said the figure. "I hate it very much. Tell me what you've got to do with it, so I know exactly what it is I'm hating." Dirk stared at the neat, thin face in astonishment.
"Gilks," he said. "Don't stand there looking like a startled what's-his-name. What are those things that aren't seals? Much worse than seals. Big blubbery things. Dugongs. Don't stand there looking like a startled dugong. Why has that," Gilks pointed into the room behind him, "why has that man in there got your name and telephone number on an envelope full of money?"
"How much," started Dirk. "How, may I ask, do you come to be here, Gilks? What are you doing so far from the Fens? Surprised you find it dank enough for you here."
£300, said Gilks.
"Why?"
"Perhaps you'd allow me to speak to my client," said Dirk. "Your client, eh?" said Gilkes grimly. "Yes, all right. Why don't you speak to him? I'd be interested to hear what you have to say." He stood back stiffly and waved Dirk into the room. Dirk gathered his thoughts and entered the room in a state of controlled composure, which lasted for just over a second. Most of his client was sitting quietly in a comfortable chair in front of the hi-fi. The chair was placed in the optimal listening position, about twice as far back from the speakers as the distance between them, which is usually considered to be ideal for stereo imaging. He seemed generally to be casual and relaxed, with his legs crossed and a half-finished cup of coffee on the small table beside him. Distressingly, though, his head was sitting neatly on the middle of the record which was revolving on the hi-fi turntable, with the tone arm snuggling up against the neck and constantly being deflected back into the same groove. As the head revolved, it seemed once every 1.8 seconds or so to shoot Dirk a reproachful glance, as if to say, "See what happens when you don't turn up on time like I asked you to." Then it would sweep on round to the wall, round, round, and back to the front again, with more reproach. "Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it." The room swayed a little around Dirk, and he put his hand out against the wall to steady it. "Was there any particular service you were engaged to provide for your client?" said Gilkes behind him, very quietly.
"Just a small matter," said Dirk weakly. "Nothing connected with all this. No, he didn't mention any of this kind of thing at all. Well, look, I can see you're busy. I think I'd better just collect my fee and leave. You say he left it out for me?"
Having said this, Dirk sat heavily on a small bentwood chair standing behind him and broke it. Gilkes hauled him back to his feet again and propped him up against the wall. Briefly, he left the room, then came back with a small jug of water and a glass on a tray. He poured some water into the glass, took it to Dirk, and threw it at him.
"Better?"
"No," spluttered Dirk. "Can't you at least turn the record off?"
"That's forensics' job. Can't touch anything till the Cleverdicks have been. Maybe that's them now. Look, go out onto the patio and get some air. Chain yourself to the railing and beat yourself up a little. I'm pushed for time myself. And try to look less green, will you? It's not your colour."
"Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it. Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it." Gilkes turned round, looking tired and cross, and was about to go out and up the stairs to meet the newcomers, whose voices could be heard up on the ground floor, when he paused and watched the head revolving patiently on its heavy platter for a few seconds.
"You know," he said at last, "these smart-aleck show-off suicides really make me tired. They only do it to annoy."
"Suicide?" said Dirk.
Gilkes glanced round at him. "Window secured with iron bars half an inch thick," he said. "Door locked from the inside with the key still in the lock. Furniture piled against the inside of the door. French windows to the patio locked with mortise door bolts. No signs of a tunnel. If it was murder, then the murderer must have stopped to do a damn fine job of glazing on the way out, except that all the putty's old and painted over. No, nobody's left this room, and nobody's broken into it. Except for us, and I'm pretty sure we didn't do it. No, I haven't time to fiddle around on this one. Obviously suicide, and just done to be difficult. I've half a mind to do the deceased for wasting police time. Tell you what," he said, glancing at his watch, "you've got 10 minutes. If you come up with a plausible explanation of how he did it that I can put in my report, I'll let you keep the evidence in the envelope, -20% for the emotional wear and tear involved in not punching you in the mouth."
Dirk wondered for a moment whether or not to mention the visits his client claimed to have received from a strange and violent green-eyed fur-clad giant who regularly emerged out of nowhere, bellowing about contracts and obligations, and waving a 3-foot glittering-edged scythe, but decided, on balance, no. "Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it." He was seething with himself at last. He had not been able to seethe at himself properly over the death of his client, because it was too huge and horrific a burden to bear, but now he had been humiliated by Gilkes, and found himself in too wobbly and disturbed a state to fight back, so he was able to seethe at himself about that. He turned sharply away from his tormentor, and let himself out into the patio garden to be alone with his seethings. The patio was a small, paved, west-facing area at the rear, which was largely deprived of light, cut off as it was by the high back wall of the house, and by the high wall of some industrial building that backed onto the rear. In the middle of it stood, for who knew what possible reason, a stone sundial. If any light at all fell on the sundial, you'd know that it was pretty close to noon GMT. Other than that, birds perched on it. A few plants sulked in pots. Dirk jabbed a cigarette in his mouth and burnt a lot of the end of it fiercely. "Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it," still nagged from inside the house. Neat garden walls separated the patio on either side from the gardens of neighbouring houses. The one to the left was the same size as this one. The one to the right extended a little further, benefiting from the fact that the industrial building finished flush with the intervening garden wall. There was an air of well-kemptness. Nothing grand, nothing flashy, just a sense that all was well, and that upkeep on the houses was no problem. The house to the right, in particular, looked as if it had had its brickwork repointed quite recently, and its windows reglossed. Dirk took a large gulp of air, and stood for a second staring up into what could be seen of the sky, which was grey and hazy. A A single dark speck was wheeling against the underside of the clouds. Dirk watched this for a while, glad of any focus for his thoughts other than the horrors of the room he had just left. He was vaguely aware of comings and goings within the room, of a certain amount of tape measuring happening, of a feeling that photographs were being taken, and that severed head removal activities were taking place. Don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick it up, pick it up, pick it, don't pick... Somebody at last picked it up. The nagging repetition was at last hushed, and now the gentle sound of a distant television floated peacefully on the noontime air. Dirk, however, was having a great deal of difficulty in taking it all in. He was much more aware of taking a succession of huge, swimmy whacks to the head, which were the assaults of guilt. It was not the normal background noise type of guilt that comes from just being alive this far into the 20th century, and which Dirk was usually fairly adept at dealing with. It was an actual stunning sense of, this specific, terrible thing is specifically and terribly my fault. All the normal mental moves wouldn't let him get out of the path of the huge pendulum. Wham! It came again. Whiz! Wham! Again and again. Wham! 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 He tried to remember any of the details of what his late client had said to him, but it was virtually impossible. Wham! With all this whamming taking place. The man had said that he was being pursued by a large, hairy, green-eyed monster armed with a scythe. Wham! Dirk had secretly smiled to himself about this. Wham! And had thought, what a silly man. Wham! A scythe and a contract. Wham! He hadn't known or even had the faintest idea as to what the contract was for. Of course, Dirk had thought. Wham! But he had had a vague feeling that it might have had something to do with a potato. There was a bit of a complicated story attached to that. Wham! Dirk had nodded seriously at this point. Wham! And made a reassuring tick on a pad which he kept on his desk for the express purpose of making reassuring ticks on. He had prided himself at that moment on having managed to convey the impression that he had made a tick in a small box marked potatoes. Wham! Mr. Anstey had said he would explain further about the potatoes when Dirk arrived to carry out his task. And Dirk had promised, easily, casually, wham, with an airy wave of his hand, to be there at 6:30 in the morning, because the contract fell due at 7 o'clock. Wham! Dirk remembered having made another tick in a notional potato contract falls due at 7 a.m. box. Wham! He couldn't handle all this whamming anymore. He couldn't blame himself for what had happened. Well, he could. Of course he could. He did. It was, in fact, his fault. The point was that he couldn't continue to blame himself for what had happened and think clearly about it, which he was going to have to do. He would have to dig this horrible thing up by the roots, and if he was going to be fit to do it, he had somehow to divest himself, wham, of this whamming. A huge wave of anger surged over him as he contemplated his predicament and the tangled distress of his life. He hated this neat patio. He hated all this sundial stuff, and all these neatly painted windows, all these hideously trim roofs. He wanted to blame it all on the paintwork rather than on himself. On the revoltingly tidy patio paving stones, on the sheer disgusting abomination of the neatly repointed brickwork. "Excuse me?" "What?" He whirled round, caught unawares by this intrusion into his private raging of a quiet, polite voice. "Are you connected with—" The woman indicated all the unpleasantness and the lower ground floorness and the horrible sort of policeness of things next door to her, with a little floating movement of her wrist. Her wrist wore a red bracelet which matched the frames of her glasses. She was looking over the garden wall from the house on the right, with an air of slightly anxious distaste. Dirk glared at her speechlessly. She looked about 40-something-ish and neat, with an instant and unmistakable quality of advertising about her. She gave a troubled sigh. "I know it's probably all very terrible and everything," she said, "but do you think it'll take long? We only called in the police because the noise of that ghastly record was driving us up the wall. It's all a bit..." She gave him a look of silent appeal, and Dirk decided that it could all be her fault. She could, as far as he was concerned, take the blame for everything while he sorted it out. She deserved it, if only for wearing a bracelet like that. Without a word, he turned his back on her and took his fury back inside the house, where it began rapidly to freeze into something hard and efficient. "Gilks," he said, "your smart Alex suicide theory, I like it. It works for me. And I think I see how the clever bastard pulled it off. Bring me pen, bring me paper." He sat down with a flourish at the cherrywood farmhouse table which occupied the centre of the rear portion of the room, and deftly sketched out a scheme of events which involved a number of household or kitchen implements, a swinging, weighted light fitting, some very precise timing, and hinged on the vital fact that the record turntable was Japanese. "That should keep your forensic chaps happy," said Dirk briskly to Gilks. The forensic chaps glanced at it, took in its salient points, and liked them. They were simple, implausible, and of exactly that nature which a coroner who liked the same sort of holidays in Marbella which they did would be sure to relish. Unless, said Dirk casually, you're interested in the notion that the deceased had entered into some kind of diabolical contract with a supernatural agency for which payment was now being exacted? The forensic chaps glanced at each other and shook their heads. There was a strong sense from them that the morning was wearing on, and that this kind of talk was only introducing unnecessary complications into a case which otherwise would be well behind them before lunch. Dirk made a satisfied shrug, peeled off his share of the evidence, and, with a final nod to the constabulary, made his way back upstairs. As he reached the hallway, it suddenly became apparent to him that the gentle sounds of daytime television, which he had heard from out in the garden, had previously been masked from inside by the insistent sound of the record stuck in its groove. He was surprised now to realize that they were, in fact, coming from somewhere upstairs in this house. With a quick look round to see that he was not observed, he stood on the bottom step of the staircase leading to the upstairs floors of the house, and glanced up them in surprise. The stairs were carpeted with a tastefully austere matting type of substance. Dirk quietly made his way up them, past some tastefully dried large things in a pot that stood on the first landing, and looked into the rooms on the first floor. They, too, were tasteful and dried. The larger of the two bedrooms was the only one that showed any signs of current use. It had clearly been designed to allow the morning light to play on delicately arranged flowers and duvets stuffed with something like hay, but there was a feeling that socks and used shaving heads were instead beginning to gather the room into their grip. There was a distinct absence of anything female in the room, the same sort of absence that a missing picture leaves behind it on a wall. There was an air of tension and of sadness and of things needing to be cleaned out from under the bed. The bathroom, which opened out from it, had a gold disc hung on the wall in front of the lavatory, for sales of 500,000 copies of a record called Hot Potato, by a band called Pugilism and the Third Autistic Cuckoo. Dirk had a vague recollection of having read part of an interview with the leader of the band, though only two of them, and one of them was the leader, in a Sunday paper. He had been asked about their name, and he'd said there was an interesting story about it, though it turned out not to be. It can mean whatever people want it to mean, he had added with a shrug from the sofa of his manager's office, somewhere off Oxford Street. Dirk remembered visualizing the journalist nodding politely and writing this down. A vile knot had formed in Dirk's stomach, which he had eventually softened with gin. Hot potato, thought Dirk. It suddenly occurred to him, looking at the gold disc hanging in its red frame, that the record on which the late Mr. Anstey's head had been perched was obviously this one. Hot potato. Don't pick it up. What could that mean? Whatever people wanted it to mean, Dirk thought with bad grace. The other thing that he remembered now about the interview was that Payne, the leader of Pugilism and the Third Autistic Cuckoo was called Payne, claimed to have written the lyrics down more or less verbatim from a conversation which he or somebody had overheard in a cafe or a sauna or an aeroplane or something like that. Dirk wondered how the originators of the conversation would feel to hear their words being repeated in the circumstances in which he had just heard them. He peered more closely at the label in the centre of the gold record. At the top of the label it simply said, ARG, while underneath the actual title were the writer's credits, Paynton, Mulville, Anstey. Mulville was presumably the member of Pugilism and the Third Autistic Cuckoo who wasn't the leader, and Jeff Anstey's inclusion on the writing credits of a major-selling single was probably what had paid for his house. When Anstey had talked about the contract having something to do with potato, he'd assumed that Dirk knew what he meant, and he, Dirk, had as easily assumed that Anstey was blithering. It was very easy to assume that someone who was talking about green-eyed monsters with scythes was also blithering when he talked about potatoes. Dirk sighed to himself with deep uneasiness. He took a dislike to the neat way the trophy was hanging on the wall, and adjusted it a little so that it hung at a more humane and untidy angle. Doing this caused an envelope to fall out from behind the frame and flutter towards the floor. Dirk tried unsuccessfully to catch it. With an unfit grunt, he bent over and picked the thing up. It was a largish cream envelope of rich, heavy paper, roughly slit open at one end and resealed with scotch tape. In fact, it looked as if it had been opened and resealed with fresh layers of tape many times, an impression which was borne out by the number of names to which the envelope had in its time been addressed, each successively crossed out and replaced by another. The last name on it was that of Jeff Anstey. At least Dirk assumed that it was the last name, because it was the only one that had not been crossed out, and crossed out heavily. Dirk peered at some of the other names, trying to make them out. Some memory was stirred by a couple of the names which he could just about discern, but he needed to examine the envelope much more closely. He had been meaning to buy himself a magnifying glass ever since he had become a detective, but had never got around to it. He also did not possess a penknife, so, reluctantly, he decided that the most prudent course was to tuck the envelope away for the moment in one of the deeper recesses of his coat and examine it later in privacy. He glanced quickly behind the frame of the gold disc to see if any other goodies might emerge, but was disappointed, and so he quit the bathroom and resumed his exploration of the house. The other bedroom was neat and soulless, unused. A pine bed, a duvet, and an old battered chest of drawers that had been revived by being plunged into a vat of acid were its main features. Dirk pulled the door of it closed behind him and started to ascend the small, wobbly, white-painted stairway that led up to an attic room, from which the sounds of Bugs Bunny could be heard. At the top of the stairs was a minute landing, which opened on one side into a bathroom so small that it would best be used by someone standing outside and sticking into it whichever limb you wanted to wash. The door to it was kept ajar by a length of green hosepipe, which trailed from the cold tap of the washbasin, out of the bathroom, across the landing, and into the only other room here at the top of the house. It was an attic room with a severely pitched roof, which offered only a few spots where a person of anything approaching average height could stand up. Dirk stood hunched in the doorway and surveyed its contents, nervous of what he might find amongst them. There was a general grunginess about the place. The curtains were closed, and little light made it past them into the room, which was otherwise illuminated only by the flickering glow of an animated rabbit. An unmade bed with dank, screwed-up sheets was pushed under a particularly low angle of the ceiling. Parts of the walls and the more nearly vertical surfaces of the ceiling were covered with pictures crudely cut out of magazines. The hosepipe curled across the floor and led around the side of an elderly armchair pulled up in front of the television set. The rabbit rampaged. The glow of his rampagings played on the frayed edges of the armchair. Bugs was wrestling with the controls of an aeroplane which was plunging to the ground. Suddenly he saw a button marked autopilot and pressed it. A cupboard opened, and a robot pilot clambered out, took one look at the situation, and bailed out. The plane hurtled on towards the ground, but, luckily, ran out of fuel just before reaching it, and so the rabbit was saved. Dirk could also see the top of a head. The hair on this head was dark, matted, and greasy. Dirk watched it for a long, uneasy moment before advancing slowly into the room to see what, if anything, it was attached to. His relief at discovering, as he rounded the armchair, that the head was, after all, attached to a living body, was a little marred by the sight of the living body to which it was attached. Slumped in the armchair was a boy. He was probably about 13 or 14, and although he didn't look ill in any specific physical way, he was definitely not a well person. His hair sagged on his head sagged on his shoulders, and he lay in the armchair in a sort of limp, crumpled way, as if he'd been hurled there from a passing train. He was dressed merely in a cheap leather jacket and sleeping bag. Dirk stared at him. Who was he? What was a boy doing here watching television in a house where someone had just been decapitated? Did he know what had happened? Did Gilks know about him? Had Gilks even bothered to come up here? It was, after all, several flights of stairs for a busy policeman with a tricky suicide on his hands. After Dirk had been standing there for 20 seconds or so, the boy's eyes climbed up towards him, failed utterly to acknowledge him in any way at all, and then dropped again and locked back onto the rabbit. Dirk was unused to making quite such a minuscule impact on anybody. He checked to be sure that he did have his huge leather coat and his absurd red hat on, and that he was properly and dramatically silhouetted by the light of the doorway. He felt momentarily deflated, and said, by way of self-introduction. But it didn't get the boy's attention. He didn't like this. The kid was deliberately and maliciously watching television at him. He frowned. There was a kind of steamy tension building in the room, it seemed to Dirk, a kind of difficult hissing quality to the whole air of the place, which he did not know how to respond to. It rose in intensity, and then suddenly ended with an abrupt click, which made Dirk start. The boy unwound himself like a slow, fat snake, leaned sideways over the far side of the armchair, and made some elaborate unseen preparations, which clearly involved, as Dirk now realized, an electric kettle. When he resumed his earlier splayed posture, it was with the addition of a plastic pot clutched in his right hand, from which he forked rubbery strands of steaming gunk into his mouth. The rabbit brought his affairs to a conclusion, and gave way to a jeering comedian who wished the viewers to buy a certain brand of lager on the basis of nothing better than his own hardly disinterested say-so. Dirk felt that it was time to make a slightly greater impression on the proceedings than he had so far managed to do. He stepped forward directly into the boy's line of sight. "Kid?" Dirk said in a tone that he hoped would sound firm but gentle, and not in any way at all patronizing or affected or gauche. "I need to know who..." He was distracted at that moment by the sight which met him from the new position in which he was standing. On the other side of the armchair, there was a large, half-full, catering-sized box of pot noodles, a large, half-full, catering-sized box of Mars bars, a half-demolished pyramid of cans of soft drink, and the end of the hosepipe. The hosepipe ended in a plastic tap nozzle, and was obviously used for refilling the kettle. Dirk had simply been going to ask the boy who he was, but seen from this angle, the family resemblance was unmistakable. He was clearly the son of the lately decapitated Geoffrey Anstey. Perhaps this behaviour was just his way of dealing with shock, Or perhaps he really didn't know what had happened. Or perhaps he... Dirk hardly liked to think. In fact, he was finding it hard to think clearly, while the television beside him was, on behalf of a toothpaste manufacturing company, trying to worry him deeply about some of the things which might be going on in his mouth. "Okay," he said, "I don't like to disturb you at what I know must be a difficult and distressing time for you, but I need to know, first of all, if you actually realize that this is a difficult and distressing time for you." Nothing. "All right," thought Dirk, "time for a little judicious toughness." He leant back against the wall, stuck his hands in his pockets in an "okay if that's the way you want to play it" manner, stared moodily at the floor for a few seconds, then swung his head up and let the boy have a hard look right between the eyes. "I have to tell you, kid," he said tersely, "your father's dead." This might have worked if it hadn't been for a very popular and long-running commercial which started at that moment. It seemed to Dirk to be a particularly astounding example of the genre. The opening sequence showed the angel Lucifer being hurled from heaven into the pit of hell, where he then lay on a burning lake until a passing demon arrived and gave him a can of a fizzy soft drink called Shades, spelt with a small S and a capital H. Lucifer took it and tried it. He greedily guzzled the whole contents of the can, and then turned to camera, slipped on some Porsche-designed sunglasses, said, "Now we're really cooking," and lay back basking in the glow of the burning coals being heaped around him. At that point, an impossibly deep and growly American voice, which sounded as if it had itself crawled from the pit of hell, or at least from a Soho basement drinking club, to which it was keen to return as soon as possible to marinate itself into shape for the next voiceover, said, "Shades, the drink from hell." And the can revolved a little to obscure the initial S and thus spell Hades. The theology of this seemed a little confused, reflected Dirk, but what was one tiny extra droplet of misinformation in such a raging torrent? Lucifer then mugged at the camera again and said, "I could really fall for this stuff." And just in case the viewer had been rendered completely insensate by all these goings-on, the opening shot of Lucifer being hurled from heaven was briefly replayed in order to emphasize the word fall. The boy's attention was entirely captivated by this. Dirk squatted down in between the boy and the screen. "Listen to me," he began. The boy craned his neck round to look past Dirk at the screen. He had to redistribute his limbs in the chair in order to be able to do this and continue to fork pot noodle into himself. "Listen," insisted Dirk again. Dirk felt he was beginning to be in serious danger of losing the upper hand in this situation. It wasn't merely that the boy's attention was on the television, it was that nothing else seemed to have any meaning or independent existence for him at all. Dirk was merely a featureless object in the way of the television. The boy seemed to bear him no malice, he merely wished to see past him. "Look, can we turn this off for a moment?" Dirk said, and he tried not to make it sound testy. The boy did not respond. Maybe there was a slight stiffening of the shoulders, maybe it was a shrug. Dirk turned around and was at a loss to find which button to push to turn the television off. The whole control panel seemed to be dedicated to the single purpose of keeping itself turned on. There was no single button marked on or off. Eventually Dirk simply disconnected the set from the power socket on the wall and turned back to the boy, who broke his nose. Dirk felt his septum crunching from the terrific impact of the boy's forehead as they both toppled heavily backwards against the set, but the noise of the bone breaking, and the noise of his own cry of pain as it broke, was completely obliterated by the howling screams of rage that erupted from the boy's throat. Dirk flailed helplessly to try and protect himself from the fury of the onslaught, but the boy was on top with his elbow in Dirk's eye, his knees pounding first on Dirk's ribcage, then his jaw, and then on Dirk's already traumatized nose, as he scrambled over him to try and reconnect the power to the television. He then settled back comfortably into the armchair, and watched with a moody and unsettled eye as the picture reassembled itself. "You could at least have waited for the news," he said in a dull voice. Dirk gaped at him. He sat huddled on the floor, coddling his bleeding nose in his hands, and gaped at the monstrously disinterested creature. He protested, and then gave up for the time being while he probed his nose for the damage. There was definitely a wobbly bit that clicked nastily between his fingers, and the whole thing seemed suddenly to be a horribly unfamiliar shape. He fished a handkerchief out of his pocket and held it up to his face. Blood spread easily through it. He staggered to his feet, brushed aside non-existent offers of help, stomped out of the room and into the tiny bathroom. There he yanked the hosepipe angrily off the tap, found a towel, soaked it in cold water, and held it to his face for a minute or two until the flow of blood gradually slowed to a trickle and stopped. He stared at himself in the mirror. His nose was quite definitely leaning at a slightly rakish angle. He tried bravely to shift it, but not bravely enough. It hurt abominably, so he contented himself with dabbing at it a little more with the wet towel and swearing quietly. Then he stood there for a second or two longer, leaning against the basin, breathing heavily, and practicing saying, "All right," fiercely into the mirror. It came out as "All right," and lacked any real authority. When he felt sufficiently braced, or at least as braced as he was likely to feel in the immediate future, he turned and stalked grimly back into the den of the beast. The beast was sitting quietly absorbing news of some of the exciting and stimulating game shows that the evening held in store for the determined viewer, and did not look up as Dirk re-entered. Dirk walked briskly over to the window and drew the curtains sharply back, half hoping that the beast might shrivel up shrieking if exposed to daylight, but other than wrinkling up its nose, it did not react. A dark shadow flapped briefly across the window, but the angle was such that Dirk could not see what caused it. He turned and faced the boy beast. The midday news bulletin was starting on television, and the boy seemed somehow a little more open, a little more receptive to the world outside the flickering coloured rectangle. He glanced up at Dirk with a sour, tired look. "What do you want, anyway?" he said.
"I'll tell you what I wad," said Dirk, fiercely but hopelessly. "I wad... I got a bobbed. I know that faith."
Dirk's attention had switched suddenly to the television screen, where a rather more up-to-date photograph of the missing airline check-in girl was being shown.
"What are you doing here?" said the boy.
"Psh!" said Dirk, and perched himself down on the arm of the chair, peering intently at the face on the screen. It had been taken about a year ago, before the girl had learnt about corporate lip gloss. She had frizzy hair and a frumpy put-upon look.
"Who are you? What's going on?" insisted the boy.
"Look, shut up!" snapped Dirk. "I've tried to watch this." The newscaster said that the police professed themselves to be mystified by the fact that there was no trace of Janice Smith at the scene of the incident. They explained that there was a limit to the number of times they could search the same buildings and appealed for anyone who might have a clue as to her whereabouts to come forward.
"That's my secretary! That's Miss Pierce!" exclaimed Dirk in astonishment.
The boy was not interested in Dirk's ex-secretary and gave up trying to attract Dirk's attention. He wriggled out of the sleeping bag and sloped off to the bathroom. Dirk sat staring at the television, bewildered that he hadn't realised before who the missing girl was. Still, there was no reason why he should have done, he realised. Marriage had changed her name, and this was the first time they had shown a photograph that actually identified her. So far, he had taken no real interest in the strange incident at the airport, but now it demanded his attention. The explosion was now officially designated an act of God. But, thought Dirk, what God? And why? What God would be hanging around Terminal 2 of Heathrow Airport trying to catch the 1537 flight to Oslo? After the miserable lassitude of the last few weeks, he suddenly had a great deal that required his immediate attention. He frowned in deep thought for a few moments, and hardly noticed when the beast boy snuck back in and snuggled back into his sleeping bag just in time for the advertisements to start. The first one showed how a perfectly ordinary stock cube could form the natural focus of a normal, happy family life. Dirk leapt to his feet, but even as he was about to start questioning the boy again, his heart sank as he looked at him. The beast was far away, sunk back in his dark, flickering lair, and Dirk did not feel inclined to disturb him again at the moment. He contented himself with barking at the unresponding child that he would be back, and bustled heavily down the stairs, his big leather coat flapping madly behind him. In the hallway he encountered the loathed Gilks once more. "What happened to you?" said the policeman sharply, catching sight of Dirk's bruised and bulging nose.
"Only what you told me," said Dirk innocently. "I beat myself up."
Gilks demanded to know what he'd been doing, and Dirk generously explained that there was a witness upstairs with some interesting information to impart. He suggested that Gilks go and have a word with him, but that it would be best if he turned off the television first. Gilks nodded curtly. He started to go up the stairs, but Dirk stopped him.
"Does anything strike you as strange about this house?" he said.
"What did you say?" said Gilks in irritation.
"Something strange," said Dirk.
"Something what?"
"Strange," insisted Dirk.
"Strange?
That's right, strange."
Gilks shrugged. "Like what?" he said.
"It seems to be completely soulless."
"Completely what?"
"Soulless." He tried again. "Soulless. I think that's very interesting."
With that, he doffed his hat politely and swept on out of the house and up the street, where an eagle swooped out of the sky at him and came within a whisker of causing him to fall under a 73 bus on its way south. For the next 20 minutes, hideous yells and screams emanated from the top floor of the house in Lupton Road and caused much tension among the neighbours. The ambulance took away the upper and lower remains of Mr. Anstey and also a policeman with a bleeding face. For a short while after this, there was quietness. Then another police car drew up outside the house. A lot of "Bob's here," type of remarks floated from the house as an extremely large and burly policeman heaved himself out of the car and bustled up the steps. A few minutes and a great deal of screaming and yelling later, he re-emerged, also clutching his face, and drove off in deep dudgeon, squealing his tyres in a violent and unnecessary manner. 20 minutes later, a van arrived, from which emerged another policeman, carrying a tiny pocket television set. He entered the house, and re-emerged a short while later, leading a docile 13-year-old boy, who was content with his new toy. Once all policemen had departed, save for the single squad car which remained parked outside to keep watch on the house, a large, hairy, green-eyed figure emerged from its hiding place behind one of the molecules in the large basement room. It propped its scythe against one of the hi-fi speakers, dipped a long, gnarled finger in the almost congealed pool of blood that had collected on the deck of the turntable, smeared the finger across the bottom of a sheet of thick, yellowing paper, and then disappeared off into a dark and hidden other world, whistling a strange and vicious tune, and returning only briefly to collect its scythe. A little earlier in the morning, at a comfortable distance from all these events, set at a comfortable distance from a well-proportioned window, through which cool mid-morning light was streaming, lay an elderly, one-eyed man in a white bed. A newspaper sat like a half-collapsed tent on the floor, where it had been hurled 2 minutes before, at shortly after 10 o'clock, by the clock on the bedside table. The room was not large, but was furnished in excessively bland good taste, as if it were a room in an expensive private hospital or clinic, which is exactly what it was, the Woodshead Hospital, set in its own small but well-kempt grounds, on the outskirts of a small but well-kempt village in the Cotswolds. The man was awake, but not glad to be. His skin was very delicately old, like finely stretched translucent parchment, delicately freckled. His exquisitely frail hands lay slightly curled on the pure white linen sheets, and quivered very faintly. His name was variously given as Mr. Odwin, or Wodin, or Odin. He was, is, a god. And furthermore, he was that least good of all gods to be alongside, a cross god. His one eye glinted. He was cross because of what he'd been reading in the newspapers, which was that another god had been cutting loose and making a nuisance of himself. It didn't say that in the newspapers, of course. It didn't say, God cuts loose, makes nuisance of himself in airport. It merely described the resulting devastation, and was at a loss to draw any meaningful conclusions from it. The story had been deeply unsatisfactory in all sorts of ways, on account of its perplexing inconclusiveness, its going-nowhereness, and the irritating, from the newspaper's point of view, lack of any good, solid carnage. There was, of course, a mystery attached to the lack of carnage, but a newspaper preferred a good whack of carnage to a mere mystery any day of the week. Odin, however, had no such difficulty in knowing what was going on. The accounts had Thor written all over them in letters much too big for anyone other than another god to see. He had thrown this morning's paper aside in irritation, and was now trying to concentrate on his relaxation exercises in order to avoid getting too disturbed about all of this. These involved breathing in a certain way, and breathing out in a certain other way, and were good for his blood pressure, and so on. It was not as if he was about to die or anything, ha! But there was no doubt that at his time of life, ha! He preferred to take things easy, and look after himself. Best of all, he liked to sleep. Sleeping was a very important activity for him. He liked to sleep for longish periods, great swathes of time. Merely sleeping overnight was not taking the business seriously. He enjoyed a good night's sleep and wouldn't miss one for the world, but he didn't regard it as anything even half approaching enough. He liked to be asleep by 11:30 in the morning, if possible, and if that could come directly after a nice leisurely lie-in, then so much the better. A little light breakfast and a quick trip to the bathroom while fresh linen was applied to his bed is really all the activity he liked to undertake, and he took care that it didn't jangle the sleepiness out of him and thus disturb his afternoon of napping. Sometimes he was able to spend an entire week asleep, and this he regarded as a good snooze. He'd also slept through the whole of 1986 and hadn't missed it. But he knew to his deep disgruntlement that he would shortly have to arise and undertake a sacred and irritating trust. Sacred because it was godlike, or at least involved gods, and irritating because of the particular god that it involved. Sneakily, he twitched the curtains at a distance, using nothing but his divine will. He sighed heavily. He needed to think, and, what was more, it was time for his morning visit to the bathroom. He rang for the orderly. The orderly arrived promptly in his well-pressed, loose green tunic, good-morninged cheerfully, and bustled around locating bedroom slippers and dressing-gown. He helped Odin out of bed, which was a little like rolling a stuffed crow out of a box, and escorted him slowly to the bathroom. Odin walked stiffly, like a head hung between two heavy stilts, draped in striped viola and white toweling. The orderly knew Odin as Mr. Odwin, and didn't realize that he was a god, which was something that Odin tended to keep quiet about, and wished that Thor would too. Thor was the god of thunder, and, frankly, acted like it. It was inappropriate. He seemed unwilling, or unable, or maybe just too stupid to understand or accept. Odin stopped himself. He sensed that he was beginning mentally to rant. He would have to consider calmly what next to do about Thor, and he was on his way to the right place for a good think.